May it please the court. My name is Harmon Graves, registration number 3710. Seated at council table with me is Joyce Martinez, the plaintiff appellant in this case. This case is about a commercial general liability policy issued to Mrs. Martinez Builder. With some nostalgia, I recall back to 1986, these policies were called comprehensive general liability policies. And that name carried with it some high expectation of comprehensive coverage. Since that time, this concept has suffered some erosion. General Security versus Massachusetts Mutual caused such an uproar among insurers, insureds, builders, and homeowners that the General Assembly adopted House Bill 103094 in 2010 to reset the stage upon which these coverage contests were going to be played. It is indeed a statute on steroids. It states a broad public policy. It establishes a presumption that the work performed by the insured would be deemed accidental, and it also provides for interpretation rules favorable to finding coverage. House Bill 1394 caused so altered the playing field that Judge Colt, who decided our case and granted Pro Builders' motion for summary judgment in this case, was caused to remark at the conclusion of his opinion. A different result would be warranted in this case if the statute were to apply retroactively. Judge Colt refused to do so, and I would like to discuss that first in my presentation today.
Can I ask you, Mr. Graves, before you go on, the statute also specifically says the exclusions in the policy still apply, right?
They do indeed.
You've made an argument in your briefs that I guess I'm not sure I followed as to whether you apply the presumption first or the exclusion first. Assuming you're correct and you apply the presumption first, does it make a practical difference?
Yes, indeed. I think we have to do it in a two-step process. The presumption applies that it is an occurrence, and then the exclusion only comes into play if there is an occurrence.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I interrupted you. I apologize.
That's right. But I think that's the step we have to take. So it's a two-step process. We first have to find an occurrence. I think it's a mistake to leap to the exclusions, because then we get into discussions by the court as to fortuity and a number of other things that I will address briefly, but that's the concern I have. If we get out of that step process, we get in trouble, and that's where some of these cases have gone in the wrong direction as I see them.
Right now, and the risk of taking up too much of your time, and I apologize in advance. Some of the exclusions, it seems to me, doesn't matter, and I'll just be right up front with you. I have a real question in my mind as to why the subcontractor exclusion does not apply here. I think it is a pretty strong argument it applies and bars coverage. I'd be very interested, and you could take whatever order you want to do it in, but I'd be very interested in your answer to that. It doesn't seem to me that that I'll assume the presumption applies first. I don't think it matters for that one, I guess is what I'm getting at. So whatever, I'd appreciate it if you would, before your time is up, address the subcontractor exclusion.
I'll address that right now, if I may. The scope of that exclusion bars coverage for property damage while the insured is acting as a subcontractor. The trial court did not rely on this, and Pro Builders, of course, asserts it here. I guess if we listen to the admonition in Greystone in the 10th Circuit, exclusions not addressed by the trial court probably should go back to the trial court and not be resolved by this court. But I think I can take this head on, and I'd like to do so. There was a certificate of insurance issued by Pro Builders' authorized agent, and that certificate described Wells, the contractor, operations as follows: general contractor and framer. There was no mention of the word subcontractor.
Is the certificate of insurance part of the policy, counsel?
I believe it is.
Why? Because do you have any authority for that?
Well, yes. The authority starts, I guess, with the proposition that an agent acting for the carrier is an agent in all respects and has authority to act for the carrier within the scope of that business, and clearly issuing the certificate is part of his business and therefore binds the carrier.
It binds the carrier as to who the additional insured is, but it doesn't bind it as to coverage. For example, the policy itself says what is part of the policy, correct?
Yes.
And it does not list the certificate of insurance as being part of the policy.
That's true.
why doesn't that conclusively get rid of the issue? And even if it is part of the policy, if just the fact that the certificate of insurance mentions that it's a general contractor, why does that bind it for all purposes, that he's always a general, the company is always a general contractor, never acting as a sub?
I don't think it does, and I'll take that last question first.
Okay.
I think what we're looking for here is, was Mr. Wells a subcontractor? And I think we take issue with that.
Your client has admitted that he was, in fact, asserted that he was.
Incorrect.
In her affidavit.
No, I believe not, Your Honor. I think that's not the case.
Well, I've got an affidavit right here that says that she was acting as an individual and owner of the residential site, but she also states that she was acting as the general contractor.
It's also in the statement of facts, page 3 of your opening brief. Ms. Martinez is the owner of a residential site and acting as her own general contractor, engaged Wells to construct the framing for her residence.
All right. And I'll accept that.
Okay.
Now, here, if I may start from the beginning, I think it would be helpful because we're getting off on a road that I'll address carefully. I'm going to still say with that certificate of insurance, because I think that is a document that is binding upon the carrier. And that's the premise I'll just deal with it on. And it describes him as a general contractor and framer. He could be operating in either capacity, no question about it. He's not described as a subcontractor in that document. Mrs. Martinez was described as a additional insured. And as an additional insured, she was entitled to liability coverage for any liability to third persons arising out of the activities of Mr. Wells. Okay. That part of it isn't really important, except that it does demonstrate what Mr. Wells' reasonable expectations were. Now, I think it's clear that Mr. Wells was contemplating giving a policy to Ms. Martinez that could provide coverage.
Yes, but how can the reasonable expectation doctrine provide coverage when it's unambiguously excluded?
I'll get to that. I think his expectation was that he was going to provide a policy that would provide coverage. If, in fact, it is deemed that he was a subcontractor and admitting he was a subcontractor at that junction, he was providing a policy that was totally illusory, that would provide no coverage under any circumstances.
It would provide coverage to him if he were doing another job in which he were the general contractor, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm talking about the Martinez job. If he was intending to act as a subcontractor and provided a policy with an exclusion that said he was a subcontractor and therefore no coverage would be permitted, that would be illusory.
Is that the test for illusory coverage, is whether it provides coverage in a particular instance or not, or whether the policy provides any coverage at all?
Well, perhaps illusory is being too broad. What I think we're looking at is, what was his expectations? And I think we've got to look at that. Because Wells was not trying to cheat Ms. Martinez. He was trying to provide a policy for her that would provide some coverage, albeit with possible exclusions, and we'll get to those exclusions. But the whole otherwise would be to say that he intended right off the bat to give her a covered policy that had no coverage. And I think that would presume a fraudulent intent.
Let me ask you this. Ms. Martinez, this is her property. She contracted with him to frame a house. Her house, presumably. Is there a contract here for which he can be a subcontractor, or is he contracting directly with the owner?
Well, you've hit it. You've taken my last line in this argument. Let's look at what a subcontractor is. A subcontractor is somebody that takes a portion of a principal contractor and agrees to perform it. Well, there is no contract between Ms. Martinez as homeowner and Ms. Martinez as builder.
And not even an oral contract?
There's no oral contract, Your Honor. She's just a homeowner. And what she said in almost every instance when she had the opportunity to, she told the Board of Review, for example, I was acting as a homeowner slash builder on the project. And then she had her affidavit for default judgment. She stated, quote, "With regard to the construction of my residence, I was acting as an individual and owner of a residential site." No mention of subcontracting. She wasn't falling into that trap.
Well, actually, the document that she filed, that she called a complaint with the county, said that Mr. Wells' construction company was the framing contractor, not the general contractor. Framing isn't the whole job, is it?
No.
But not by a long shot.
No, of course not. And you know she was quoting Mr. Wells.
Where does that say that in the complaint against the contractor?
Well, are you talking about the complaint in Tuttle County?
Yes.
Okay.
It looks like this, counsel.
I see you're referring to the comment, business company name, Mike Wells, construction company, framing contractor. Yes.
And in fact, that was all he was engaged to do, was just the framing, correct?
Well, he was also acting as the prime contractor in the sense of handling the foundation and steelwork.
Yes, but as to the rest of the job, he wasn't on it. That wouldn't make him a general.
No. He had a very discreet contract. It was for the framing, foundation, and the steel.
Is the term subcontractor defined anywhere?
Only in Black's Dictionary, and that's the closest one I gave. And that is a contractor who takes portion of a principal contract and agrees to perform it. And there has to be a contract between the two. And there's no contract here.
I've, in my personal life, engaged in very much the same conduct Ms. Martinez did. That is, I did a major remodel or added a wing to a house. I designed it. I hired the people to do the work, and they did the work. And I never viewed them as subcontractors. I viewed I had a contract with some of them to do the plumbing, some of them to do the electric, some of them to do some other part, but I had no contract with myself.
That is the position we've taken in this case. I have just a few minutes left. I'm going to reserve them, I believe. Thank you.
About 2 and 3.
Yeah, I'm going to.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Jane Young, registration number 30624, here on behalf today of Pro Builder Specialty Insurance Company, RRG. We submit to the court, judges, that this matter can and should be affirmed with respect to the trial court's ruling of summary judgment based upon a finding of no duty to indemnify the underlying default judgment. And that finding can be affirmed regardless of the exact holding by the trial court. I do believe that Colorado law upholds and establishes that an appellee can support an affirming of a trial court's ruling based upon any determination that would support a finding of no coverage. Here we have any number of reasons which would support a finding of no coverage and thus no duty to indemnify the underlying default judgment. First of which, Pro Builders issued a policy to Mike Wells Construction Company. That policy was effective from March 20th, 2007 to November 18th, 2007 when it was canceled. The date of the cancellation and the effective date of the cancellation are not in dispute in the record or in this action.
Do they happen just to cover this project?
No, sir.
Okay.
The policy requires that property damage first begin for there to be coverage. Here we have a situation in which there is no evidence of actual property damage during the policy period.
If I can interrupt you, Ms. Young, what do you do about American Family? The federal court decision. I mean, there the case said, you know, essentially the building was in such a hazardous condition, and the court said that's property damage. As I understand, at least one of Ms. Martinez's arguments, that's what she says here, that this building was so unsafe that that was property damage. And American Family does seem to support her argument in that respect.
And I would argue, Judge Gabriel, that in Team Court there was evidence of the property being unsafe during the policy period. And we do not have that evidence here. If you look at the contemporaneous evidence that was submitted by Martinez, for example, to the Teller County, to the Teller Building Department, in which she identifies in her complaint, to about Mike Wells Construction. There is no allegation of uninhabitability of the structure or unsafe structure. The only allegations are the failure to obtain insurance and alleged faulty workmanship. There's nothing further beyond that during the policy period, which she's alleging.
Right, so there was no evidence at the summary judgment stage, no affidavits or anything submitted in the district court here that made the allegation of uninhabitability, et cetera?
There were allegations of uninhabitability, but at that point in time, there was no evidence of that occurring. And
that's my question. Was there an affidavit or something like that submitted with, and I just don't remember, I think I looked at it, the summary judgment briefing, you know, for example, from Ms. Martinez that said the building was uninhabitable, one that framing went up?
It was during construction, so the building would not have...
The structure would not, you couldn't even, I think her argument was you couldn't even complete the building in a way that would make it safe. They had to demolish it and start over, I think was the argument.
And I understand that that is the argument that was being made, and I believe she did assert that argument in her affidavit.
Okay.
But I don't believe that there was actual factual evidence to support that argument.
But why isn't that evidence enough? I mean, she's the homeowner, she's got plenty of experience as a contractor herself. Why didn't that get you a fact question on that point, if we have to get there?
Because that evidence was only made and asserted and found after the policy had expired. There was no contemporaneous evidence of those conditions during the policy period.
Did it have to be asserted during the policy period, or did it have to occur during the policy
period? It has to occur during the policy period.
Well, he worked on the project during the policy period, did he not?
He did.
And that's what's alleged to be the danger. Now, she may not have used the word danger until after the policy period was over, but that's neither here nor there, is it?
I agree that there's a difference, Your Honor. I do believe that there has to be an occurrence of property damage during the policy period, and there simply is no evidence to support the legal argument that is being made. And if you look at the evidence that was available at the time, the only allegations that were made were allegations of faulty workmanship, which gets to the second point of a finding that the trial court made in terms of the lack of an occurrence found, given the sole allegations of faulty workmanship during the policy period. And Mr. Graves began his argument by discussing the recent law that was enacted by the General Assembly and codified at 1320-808, in which the General Assembly purports to legislatively overrule the general security case. And general security, I believe we all know, stands generally for the proposition that faulty workmanship in and of itself is not a fortuitous occurrence and therefore not covered. We would submit that the new law that is being relied upon to establish coverage is not applicable to this policy. This was a policy that had expired years prior to the effective date of this act. This is an act that applies to policies that are only, quote, unquote, currently in existence. Now, the appellant has made an argument that an occurrence-based policy like that policy issued here is always in existence, and has cited a Village Homes case to support its proposition for that. We would submit, however, that Village Homes is not dispositive of that issue. In Village Homes, the court was asked to determine a standing question with respect to whether or not homeowners were entitled to seek coverage for homes that they acquired after the policy had expired when there was evidence of damage during the policy period. Village Homes did not resolve the question that we have here as to whether or not an act which comes into effect after a policy has expired can legislatively overturn and overrule the interpretation of that policy. You also have to look, in my view, you have to look at the phrase currently in existence. And if you take the appellant's argument to its extreme, you have to write out the word currently in the effective date provision of the act. To hold otherwise would render the term currently completely superfluous. We have other guidance to rely upon from the Colorado courts as well as the General Assembly in terms of what is a policy or an existing policy. If you look at the Ken Carl case, in which they talk about what is an existing policy, they speak to a policy that has not expired. In this instance, we have a situation in which they are trying to retroactively apply a statute that did not go into effect until years after a policy had expired. In order to do so, the General Assembly must show in evidence a very clear, unambiguous intent to do so, and we would submit that they have not.
Well, doesn't the question on this, and since I rudely interrupted Mr. Graves, I'll pick up his mantle for him here. I mean, the question seems to me not necessarily one of retroactivity. I mean, it strikes me as turning on what does in existence mean. Mr. Graves and Amici make a very vehement argument that you can look at what an occurrence policy is. The language in Village Homes that you point out is very broad, and they make an argument that the legislature was certainly aware of what an occurrence policy is and that arguably it can go on forever. So I guess where I'm going is there any legislative history, and you didn't cite any to us in the briefs that I can recall, I'm just asking, are you aware of any statement, you know, as to whether they were intending to use, by in existence, they were really thinking of occurrence policies or something different?
I have not submitted the legislative history, although I will represent to the court that I have reviewed it. And the reason why we did not submit it with our briefing is that it did not address the retroactivity. There was no statement in the legislative history of the act as to what policies it was intended to apply to and whether it was intended to provide retroactively. And I think to address a piece of your other argument, Judge Gabriel, is that you have to look at the entirety of the phrase. You have to look at currently in existence. An occurrence policy may continue and provide coverage for actions that occur during its policy period when those claims are made after the policy expires. But adding the term currently in existence, I believe, evidences intent to apply to only those policies that are indeed currently in effect and non-expired at the time the act went into effect. Provost's position, however, is that even if the act applies, there are various exclusions and other provisions in the policy that warrant a support of a denial of a duty to defend and a duty to indemnify. And one of those exclusions was what the bench had already discussed in terms of the subcontractor exclusion, which excludes property damage arising out of, related to, or connected with your work while acting as a subcontractor. This was a policy that was issued to Mike West Construction. And in that application of insurance, he identified that he is a custom home builder and a framer. But he also identified that he does zero subcontractor work. Now, this is a policy that's...
I didn't see that in the record, counsel. Where is that?
It was included in attachment or appendix B, I believe, to... the appellant's opening brief. And you will see in that application of insurance, there's a representation and a signature by Mr. Wells of an acknowledgement that this type of policy is not like necessarily every other policy. It is a liability policy that provides some coverage for specific types of actions. And this is a situation in which he had represented to the insurance carrier that he didn't do subcontractor work, which is why there's a subcontractor exception here, because the risk wasn't written for him to be done and to provide exposure for subcontractor work, which is why that exists. And I understand that there's been some significant discussion with respect to whether or not Mike Bell's construction was a subcontractor. This was a circumstance in which Martinez has admitted that she was a general contractor. She was the one who pulled the permits with respect to the building and construction.
Homeowner could do that.
I understand that, Judge Roy. But this was not a situation in which Mike Wells was running the project. Mike Wells was responsible for a discrete piece of this project with respect to framing and the foundation, and nothing further.
Responsible to whom?
Responsible to the general contractor, Mrs. Martinez. She has a written contract. Although it's...
She has a written contract with herself?
No, she has a, I believe it's a job work order, which they're calling a contract between Martinez and Mike Wells Construction. There's nothing to the contract. For example, there's no requirement to provide additional insured coverage. There's been some representations by the appellant that they believe that they're an additional insured under the policy. However, the additional insured endorsement in the policy only extends coverage when it's required in a written contract. There was no such requirement between Martinez and Mike Wells Construction in this case.
So it's your understanding that when Mr. Wells contracts with a homeowner to do a portion of a project, he's a subcontractor?
I do believe he is, because he's doing a portion of a job, not the entirety of a job. And that, I believe...
That's a distinction? I'm not aware of that distinction. The distinction I'm aware of is that someone else has a contract and parceling out the work to subcontractors.
Well, I think you can look at it a couple of different ways, Judge Roy. I believe you can look at somebody being a subcontractor and contracting with the owner general contractor in this instance to do a portion of that job. I don't know that you have to have an existing contract that necessarily then flows into another subcontract relationship. I believe that the key piece to a subcontract is that they are contracting with a general contractor in this circumstance, which Martinez admittedly has conceded that she is, to do a portion of that job, not the entirety of it. I do believe there's also another exclusion that's applicable here, which is exclusion J6.
Before we get there, counsel, though, what's your position with regard to the certificate of liability that lists Mike Wells Construction as a general contractor and framer?
The certificate of liability insurance is not binding on the insurance carrier. The certificate of liability insurance very clearly states it does not alter, change, or amend any of the terms of the coverage provided by the policy. The certificate may say what it says, but ultimately we look to the policy to evaluate to what extent there's coverage.
What about the declaration?
The declaration of?
Of insurance. It's usually the cover page on an insurance policy. Is that part of the policy or not?
It is part of the policy, yes.
Okay. Isn't he described as a general contractor framer there?
No. I don't believe so.
Okay.
And I know you wanted to move on, Ms. Young, but can I ask you, is there, and at the risk of a foolish question, but you know this stuff better than I, is there a definition of what subcontractor means for purposes of that exclusion in the policy?
No, there's not. Right. I think you have to look to the ordinary and plain meaning of that, which I believe to be when an individual contracts with a general contractor to do a portion of the job, that contract is then a subcontract.
All right, and would that apply if there was, and I suppose Ms. Martinez says, I didn't have a contract with myself. So in that, and let's assume it's just a homeowner hiring Mr. Wells to do the framing. Is Mr. Wells a contractor or a subcontractor in that situation?
I believe he is a subcontractor.
Because he's just doing a part of a
Correct.
Bigger job.
I think if you represent that he is a contractor, it enables and shows him having more responsibilities other than what he has agreed to by virtue of his contract to handle a portion of a job. Very briefly, I believe one of the very key, the key exclusion here is exclusion J6 in the policy, which is very similar to exclusion 11F that was interpreted and upheld by this court in the McGowan case. I believe the situations here between the McGowan case and this case are very similar in that exclusion J6 excludes coverage for property damage. The property must be repaired or restored because your work was incorrectly performed. If Ms. Martinez is correct and that property damage caused by an occurrence was sustained during the policy period, that damage necessarily occurred before the work was complete. She has argued that she removed Mike Wells from the project. But removal is not the dispositive component in evaluating exclusion J6 and whether the work is completed. ProBuilders submits to your honors that there is a basis, a number of basis, to uphold the denial of coverage and no duty to indemnify, and we ask that you do so. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I'd like to, I'd like to first address the retroactivity issue. I think a very well-reasoned case occurred very recently out of the District Court of Larimer County, Judge Field. And she, in American States versus JP Enterprises, indicated that the language of the statute is abundantly clear to establish the legislative intent. And I've looked at that language and I've looked at her argument and I like it, and it goes like this. This act applies to all insurance policies currently existing or issued on or after the date of enactment. Now, Judge Field points out that distinction, and she thinks it's controlling. It refers to policies in existence and policies that are going to issue after May 21, 2010. In existence, she indicated, refers to policies before May 21, 2010 and are, quote, still operative. If we ignore the operation of the policy, then we're ignoring the guts of a current policy, because the policy that we have here only requires that you have an occurrence property damage within the policy period, but allows the action to take place against the policy at a subsequent time. And that is the very essence of an occurrence policy. And what happened in the Greystone case was that that was narrowed unnecessarily by the 10th Circuit. Currently in existence, according to the 10th Circuit, means policies that have not had their terms expire. If we go there, We abandon the backbone of an occurrence policy because that is the limitation of an occurrence policy. I would like to focus briefly on exclusion J6 and Judge Roy McGowan case. It seems to be your case, and I would like to offer this distinction. In McGowan, the contractor agreed to do the entire house, foundation, framing, roof, windows, doors, everything else. The insured sued for completion of the house, the cost to complete the entire house. Compare that to our case, if you would, please. Wells only agreed to do the foundation, framing, and steel. All of that was deemed completed by the abandonment of the project, which I recounted in lugubrious detail in my brief, and or the termination 3 days prior to the cancellation. So I think we make those distinctions, the entire house problem with McGowan and the very separate kind of contract that is fully completed upon abandonment in our case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We thank both counsel for their briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion on issue in due course.